Hello, welcome back. I am Zach,
And I'm Ben.
and this is the Movie Vault. Today we have the intro to a very special episode where we are going to review A Fistful of Dollars.
But before we start, I want to address some business news. First of all, if you're a loyal listener, I would suggest that you listen on Spotify. No reason in particular.
Yes.
Secondly, we thank you for listening. If you'd ever like to email us for any reason, email us at themovievaultpod@gmail.com. We would love to hear any of your comments, concerns, or questions. And finally, follow us on Instagram at themovievaultpod or on Twitter at movievaultpod, and message us on there. We do need to update our logo on Twitter, but we will do that. All right, back to the episode.
Interestingly enough, we did have someone email us lately.
Wait, really?
Yeah. It was this husband and wife asking for some marriage advice.
Oh, really?
And they were fighting about which movie to watch. Should they watch Princess Bride or Saw 10?
Oh, man. That's a tough decision.
Yeah.
Saw 10 hasn't even come out yet.
Well, and they were fighting over it. It was really affecting their marriage. So so I sat down with them and we talked about it.
Right.
And
right.
They're good now. But we ended up compromising on Arrival.
Arrival?
Yeah.
That's the middle of The Princess Bride and Saw 10.
Yeah, because neither of them liked that one. So we compromised on something that neither of them
likes.
So it's
like, I guess that makes sense. That
mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
The odd part is the guy wanted The Princess Bride, but that's another story.
Oh,
anyway,
okay.
We're reviewing A Fistful of Dollars. This is the first in a loosely based trilogy by Sergio Leone, the director, and the other two movies are A Few Dollars More, correct? And what is it? The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, of course. Ben's getting his notes.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood stars in these. These are spaghetti westerns, right?
Yep.
I'm just double checking.
I think that's just the lingo because they were filmed in Italy.
Oh.
Like they're filmed in Italy, so people call them spaghetti westerns.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You're so smart. Wow. And yeah, so, and these really did define a new genre of spaghetti western filmmaking. You know, these influenced things, we'll talk about it later, but influenced bigger projects like even The Mandalorian that you're probably watching.
Oh, The Mandalorian's so influenced by spaghetti
westerns. And you can see it clearly after watching this, in the music and in the shots, everything like that, but even the fights sometimes. So without further ado, Ben, take it away with the intro. This was 1966, right?
Yes. So A Fistful of Dollars was made in 1964.
Oh.
I just said yes, and it was made in 1964. So we already corrected one thing. It stars Clint Eastwood, who you may have heard of. He's kind of famous. And a bunch of other people who you probably have never heard of, including Jean-Marie Volante, Marianne Koch, Wolfgang Lucksky, Serge Hart Rupp, Jose Calvo, Antonio Perito, and Joseph Egger. So a lot of these people were European, I believe. Yeah, Spanish, they were Austrian, German, and Italian. So there's one Italian guy in this, and then there's a bunch of other European people. And then Clint Eastwood, of course. Clint Eastwood was paid $15,000 for his role, and this was made for $200,000. It also grossed $19 million. So,
but this over was the span of how long? There's no way it was right there and then. $19 million
box office.
What is that nowadays?
It released in Italy, and it had a negative reviews from Italian critics, but a grassroots popularity spread over the film's theatrical release, grossing $2.7 million. Lire, which is Italian currency.
So and it then, was released in the America and Canada a few years later in 1967, which added 14.5 million within that run. So that's crazy.
Yeah.
So it really made the bulk in the North American.
Yeah, but
sector.
It still made a decent amount compared to $200,000. I mean, and the bottom line is Clint Eastwood got ripped off.
We'll have to see if he gets a pay increase in the next two.
But you gotta think though that I mean I'm not familiar too much with Clint Eastwood's career, but this was probably good for his career long term.
Yeah,
being in this movie.
I mean, this is like the main thing.
It's kind of like you get a low pay cut, you get successful, and then you become a director that directed a bunch of movies, and then you get to be in the movies that you direct, which is kind of his career.
Yeah. Was it the latest movie he was in was The Mule? I haven't seen it. That was like 2019.
He's so old now, and he's still making movies. I think he's making another one.
Are you serious? I mean, he's like 80. He's in his 80s. So, I mean, Scorsese's in his 80s, right? He's 82. So, I mean, people are still kicking it at it in those 80s. I mean, might be good. We'll see if Killers of Flower Moon is good, actually. We'll see. But
supposedly his final film is... Oh, he also made a film called Cry Macho. I forgot about that one.
And HBO Max.
His final film is supposedly going to be called Juror Number 2. Don't know why. Anyway, so back to A Fistful of Dollars. I'd love to know more about the background of how Sergio Leone ended up making Western movies, but I don't know that. I could probably look it up real quick. But essentially, if we're just talking about the plot of this movie, it's actually based on an Italian film, or Italian, Japanese film by Akira Kurosawa called Yojimbo. And I'm probably butchering that pronunciation. And it's a very fairly simple plot structure. A guy who nobody knows his name arrives in a town. The town has two bosses, really like four bosses, but three of them are in one family. The Rojo brothers, and then the town sheriff, John Baxter, who is also a criminal. So law is not really a thing in this town. And they basically are always warring. It's known as a place of death. A lot of people die. There's a guy whose job is to make coffins, and he has pretty good business there in town. One thing I really noticed is that there really doesn't seem to be that many women or children in this town.
Yeah, there's one
or
child.
Really any other people besides the Baxters or Rojos, which is like it is like literally like there's a saloon owner, there's the Baxters at the Rojos, and there's nobody else. So calling it a town seems a little bit.
There are there are enough buildings for a town. They just maybe the people are inside hiding.
Yeah, that's kind of odd. They probably just couldn't afford to pay for extras, but
I don't know. They're paying $15,000 for Clint. I feel like they have some extra.
That's true. So in order to make money, the stranger decides that he wants to, as he describes it, the Rojos on one side, the Baxters on the other, him in the middle. So essentially he's trying to make a buck or two off of both of them by doing the kind of like, you know, when there's two countries and they're at war and there's that one country that will sell arms to both countries.
Us.
That's kind of what Clint Eastwood was doing on a smaller scale in this movie. So you could say a lot of people probably copied his strategy over time since this movie came out. There's a lot of things that happen, but there's a chest of gold that is taken by the Rojos, and they kill a bunch of soldiers from...
Government
soldiers from the Mexican army.
I think it's the Mexican government.
The Mexican government, yeah. So they steal that because they dress up as soldiers opposing that they're going to make a deal with, which I couldn't figure out how this whole thing worked out that they happened to have all these... The army basically seemed like idiots because how could they not know that
I don't know.
This was the Rojos dressed up as other people? But they got completely scammed and massacred. But while that's happening, the stranger searches the Rojos' house for gold and then accidentally knocks out Mirasol. There's a couple other things that happen, but we basically find out that who Mirasol is she's this lady who's basically been kidnapped by the Rojos to be with the main one. What's his name? Ramon. Ramon Rojo. And she doesn't want to be with him, but we don't really know this at the start. The very first scene is actually kind of odd because it's like there's this kid and this girl, and then all of a sudden this guy starts shooting at the kid.
Yeah, like toward his feet. It was to scare.
To scare him. Yeah. But it's still like he's a kid, and he goes back into this house.
He's a man if he can talk.
It's still kind of confusing. We'll get into the family dynamics, but it's a bit of an odd situation. So
it's a little weird.
One of the things that happens is that the stranger is selling information to both sides, but he's also manipulating the situation so that he is kind of controlling what's going on. So he's like, "I'll give you $500 if you do this," and then he does it. But then he goes to the other family and is like, "They're gonna do this. Give me $500 for this information," and kind of sets them up. So he has these opportunities to like steal more money and stuff like that. He makes friends with the local bartender, who I don't know why he wants to be friends with him, but he must be lonely. I think that guy's...
I feel like they were already friends.
I think that guy's... Oh, yeah, maybe they were already friends. That could be. Is that Silvantio. I can't pronounce these names. He's the bartender. And he's advising... He advises the stranger to get out of town. So...
I mean, that's a good friend, I bet.
Yeah. I'm just all out of shorts, and I'm realizing that maybe I should have just looked at my notes.
Technical.
They're better than Wikipedia. So, some highlights from the movie is the very opening credits.
Yeah, no, the opening credits were good. I think
were really,
it was
were
cool. It reminded really me cool. of like James Bond a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't you think? Like the shadows and the figures kind of moving around.
Yeah,
like,
they're moving around. I just said that it was awesome, and I love the gunshots and how it like it shot and it like flickered the names on the shots.
It was good. And the horse movements were good for like being like a... I mean, I'm assuming those were drawn or made.
So yeah.
The horses look good. But
And then I thought it was interesting at the start of the movie, and this is really throughout the movie, they utilize a lot of like shots of Clint Eastwood, close-ups and different things. But he doesn't talk that much, so it's a very scenery and reaction based movie as opposed to being heavy on dialogue. Although there are some talkers with the Rojos, but he's one of those guys. He's suave, you know. He's always calculating what he's gonna say.
Yeah.
There's always a deeper meaning to every action. He doesn't always win in every scene, but he usually has the upper hand. And it's even at one point. One of the Rojos says, "This guy's too smart to keep around." Like they can just tell that he's smart right away. Maybe it's just that everyone else is really not that smart. But
no, you're right. The one thing I thought of though, like him always knowing what to do and having like these like a gadget for every situation, a move, or and always being the fastest one to his gun, did remind me of the Mandalorian. And I'm not gonna make this comparison after this, but because it'll be annoying, but. The Mandalorian in the episodes is always like the best shooter, always the best flyer, you know?
Yeah.
And he never really has problems with a skill set going up against him and being, you know, more highly advanced than him. So, and he barely talks, you know? And it really is like so much of the Mandalorian is drawn from this. That's the only comparison I'll make to not ruin the rich history of this movie.
Yeah.
But the fact of this being the protagonist, the hero, already knowing like he doesn't necessarily care what's right and wrong, but he already has what's in his head of like who he is and what he's gonna do, so you don't really get into the questions of like his emotions, you know. You don't get into like what does he value even, but you do see some of that when, you know, some of these more vulnerable people get attacked, such as the child or the woman. So yeah, I mean you see some sides of him that are more emotional, but I don't think that's the point of him. I think the point of him is to kind of stick to the protagonist, be the hero. But also, he's not even a hero. He's like kind of ripping these people off, but they're bad people.
In a way, he's kind of the first version of like an anti-hero, because he's like, but it's not quite to the point that it is today, because because people would justify it a little bit, and they're probably not really right in justifying it this way, but by saying that like he's doing all this stuff to bad people, so it's fine, and he's helping the good people. But you could say that that is probably still justifying something that's overall bad, because you're still not supposed to steal.
Well, what do you think?
It's like Robin. I mean, it's basically based off Robin Hood, probably. Like,
yeah,
steal
similar.
From the rich. Although he's not giving to the poor, he's just stealing it, as far as we know.
But I mean,
although he does give the money to the family, as we'll get to that a little bit later. Hopefully we actually get to it. Sometimes I say that and we don't get to it. But there's some interesting stuff with like the army, because he uses like the dead soldiers in the cemetery, and he has that amazing quote, like, the dead can be very useful sometimes. He always has those little quips. Mm-hmm. I think Zach wrote some down.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like the writing is so good because it's like they utilize every single word that's written. There's not really filler words. Maybe sometimes there is with the Rojos or the Baxters, just because they're the bad guys and they're supposed to be like a little bit more dim-witted. But with at least with the stranger or Joe or whatever you want to call him, his dialogue is never wasted, or almost never wasted.
Yeah. for sure. For the little dialogue he has, he really, I mean, many quotable lines. Yeah. What is it like? Get three coffins ready. My mistake. Four.
Yeah. That one's awesome. Although there was a couple of things that took me aback is that he immediately killed those four people. Like, I don't know. I forget the exact circumstances, but I didn't really realize his life was that in danger that he was like, oh, I have to kill these four people. But that's just kind of like, that's how it's supposed to be in the West. You know, it's ruthless. Like, you had these standoffs and people shot each other and that's just how it was.
I'm trying to think. I feel like there was some threatening going on. It wasn't like...
Yeah, it wasn't a completely... He didn't ambush these people.
Yeah.
They were trying to get him to get out. But it seemed a little bit less like life-threatening than it ended up being.
These are just things you got to look over.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. I think he is a murderer. I mean, at the end of the day, you just kind of got to accept that and just be like, that's how it is. It's their generation.
Yeah. that's what they did in that generation.
That's just how they are, you know?
Yeah. I think, like as I look through my notes, there's just, yeah, there's so many scenes. He takes the army kind of thing. And he gets both of them to go out, to kill these dead soldiers. It's so funny because the Rojos are, they just think they're so amazing, like shooting these soldiers, getting there before the Baxters, and they're really just getting played the whole time. And I love the gun battle back and forth, and then it cuts to him in the wine cellar, like looking for the candy. It was like, the candy. What? Did I just say the candy? I don't think I can do notes again, guys. It's flustering.
Ben can't go back and forth between two worlds real quick.
No. He's looking for the candy, which is the gold.
Yeah.
But
the candy, those candy gold coins.
It would be funny if it was like, it wasn't real gold coins.
No, that's awesome.
But anyway, so essentially, he ends up having a side quest where he wants to save this family, which is Mirasol, who's kidnapped. And he does so, by, how does he end up? Does he?
No, he blames it on the Baxter. Yeah. He blames the one thing on the Baxters, and then when he killed everyone in that home, the Baxters found out, and then the Rojos found out when he went back to them, and the Rojos like are torturing him, and then he goes under the thing, and then at the end he like kills them all, and they were already saved by them, but he lets them out when he goes to kill all those people and blame
the
it
Rojos
on the
are celebrating. They take Mirasol to this house, which is, this is a part of the movie that was confusing. Okay, now I'm finally back on track in my head. The house that Mirasol's husband and child were staying in is right across the street from this house that the Rojos own. And there's no other houses.
Do you think it's because they just needed the scene to be quick?
I think.
Can't be like a horse ride.
Yeah,
because
it makes no logical sense. Why, like, if these people are supposed to be hiding out, like, they're not even supposed to be in this town. He tells the husband when they exchange Mirasol for that other guy, that Baxter guy, in that one scene. He's like, I told you to get out of town. Leave now. But he's in this house that's right across the street from a house that they own. That doesn't make any sense.
This is my headcanon, is that they had to take a long horse ride to go and try to find the man with no name after he did this act, after they heard shooting. It took them a while to come over there. So I'm assuming Ramon just doesn't go over there that often.
Yeah, that must
that's
be.
That's my headcanon.
I mean, that's the only thing that can really make sense.
But you're right. They're across the street just hiding, and this stupid boy just keeps crying and crying and crying. Just like, I want to see Mama, but just shut up. You're going to kill her. You're going to get her killed, you know? So.
Yes.
But no, the scene was very quick. It's like he goes, shoots them, 2 seconds later, grabs the girl, says, go, leave. And he's like, and apparently he has a history, a backstory where he knew someone who needed to be saved, but it was too late, you know?
Yeah, and then I forgot the part where the Rojos literally go back and kill all of the Baxters. Yeah. Just, like, murder them all.
Yeah.
That's pretty... I was trying to figure out, like, why they didn't do that earlier. Like,
I don't know.
If they had that... If they could, because it didn't seem like... Maybe it's just they happened to catch the Baxters in a very unexpected moment, but it really seemed like they way overpowered the Baxters.
Maybe they're, like, enjoying the ride. You know, when you're on a roller coaster, like, you're not on the top yet.
Like, they know they can do it anytime.
Yeah,
just
enjoy
waiting.
The low parts.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you have the power, like, why do it now, you know?
Yeah. And, of course, the stranger gets away through the coffin because he makes friends with that one guy. So that's pretty cool. Then he comes back because the Rojos are trying to find the stranger. I'm assuming. Oh, they've captured the pub owner there, beaten him up. He doesn't know. Well, he does know actually, because they're taking care of him in that one house that was across the street from the Rojos. They're idiots and they don't know about this house. No, he's actually not in the house. He's in like some sort of cave or something that we didn't know about.
The man
before.
With no name?
Yeah, the man with no name is in a cave.
Yeah, he's like hiding and looking out and watching it, and then he goes under the porch.
Yeah. Then he goes under the porch, and then he eventually comes to town in an amazing scene where it's him versus Ramon, and he keeps shooting at him, and it looks like he's hitting him, but then the stranger just keeps getting up, and you're kind of confused, and he tells Ramon to aim at the heart, kind of taunting him, referencing back a scene where he shoots a heart into a piece of armor. And then that foreshadows that he was using a piece of armor in order to protect himself.
Clever man.
So
he's very too smart.
Very clever. And then they eventually, and of course they had the whole thing where he had like a 45 and Ramon has a Winchester rifle. And Ramon says that the guy with the pistol will always be the dead man.
Mm-hmm.
And then naturally the stranger wins in that battle.
When a man with a 45 and a man with a rifle meet, the man with the 45 is a dead man. The man with the pistol is a dead man.
Yeah.
That's a good line.
It's a good line. So I think what you see in this is a lot of just, it's probably the like skeleton of every spaghetti Western potentially. I mean, we're going to watch two more, so we'll see how similar it is. But a lot of use of foreshadowing. It's like no piece of the puzzle is unused almost by the end. So, like, especially as you look back, you can see where they were pointing. It's a fairly simple plot, you know, not super complicated, but it's still very satisfying because you love the character of the stranger, mm-hmm. and you want to see, you know, he's better than everyone, but you just want to see him prove it. And then you get to see him get beat up once, so you know that he loses every once in a while.
And he goes so fast, like, and then he shoots the rope to knock his friend down.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah, he does the thing where I don't even know that you can actually do this, but he can re-cock the revolver so fast that it's like, it's almost like an automatic weapon at that point.
Yeah, I think that's like what people were trying to get skilled at, and that's like whoever could do that the fastest was like the best shooter.
Yeah.
So I think that was
a skill. Like, not only does he do it fast, but he's also extremely accurate. Probably unrealistically accurate, maybe. But it's a movie, so
maybe.
It's amazing.
If someone could actually do that, I wouldn't be surprised, but that's like insane. That's crazy.
Yeah, it would take a lot of skill and a lot of training
yeah.
in order to be able to do something like that.
But I mean, what are some of the clever things? I think the man with no name, you know, he has his struggles, but at the end of the day, he doesn't really have any competition. It's like, it's no competition. He's more clever. Like when I think of clever things that he's done, you know, first he goes and sneaks and overhears one of the Rojo brothers talking about like, oh, should we kill him? You know, I can kill him right here, right now. He's like, no, don't kill him. You know, he's just like secretly spying on these people constantly throughout the film, knowing what's going on. Because, I mean, a mere scrap of information, a man's life could depend on it. You know, something that's a line.
Yeah.
I think I said it backwards. But and then another thing, like to get away from the scene, he just goes and hides in a coffin. You know, he really is the smartest one there. And it goes to show that really, this is not me plugging brain, but the brain really does overpower the gun at that point because he had the information and his life depended on it. He had the information to stay away, to not stay in this house because he could have been in danger. He had the information to, you know, he just thought about the process of like, where should I hide? Where should I go? And all of these things like were the things that made him win. It wasn't, you know, you see these shootouts where they're like a standoff is what they call it, and he's shooting very fast, but the only way he gets to those points is because he is using his brain. So
right.
He really is the smartest guy in the room, and he's too smart, as they foreshadowed at the beginning, as Ramon said.
So. Ramon, the brothers, you got the old brother whose name is it's not Esteban, Don Miguel Rojo. He's sort of like the elder brother. Ramon is like the lead brother. I imagine him to be the middle brother. I don't know whether they ever actually say.
Do you think anyone ever listens to the youngest brother?
And then Esteban's like the muscle, the handsome muscle, who they probably don't really listen to. Because at some point, don't they say he's dumb? Like,
well, Don was the one who wanted to kill the man with no name, right?
Don Miguel.
Yeah. Or is that Esteban? No, that was Esteban.
Esteban wanted to kill
him. That's right. Yeah. He's
Don
like
Miguel
the feisty,
was the
emotional
one.
One.
Yeah, which maybe he was right, like, actually.
Yeah.
Like, maybe the other guys were overthinking it.
I mean, I'm just saying, there are many moments where people could have killed each other. Like, yeah. There was one part where Ramon was aiming his gun at the man with no name, but he needed to be dramatic, so he let them talk, you know? I don't know if it's a respect thing. Like, why do people do standoffs? Like, why don't you just shoot? Why do you have to wait and then do, like, a 3-2-1 or, like, a go quick? I know you don't do a 3-2-1, but, like, you're waiting, right? Why wait? What is that?
That is a good question. For some reason, it always makes sense that they do it, but then you're like, at the same time, why don't we just shoot?
But I mean, like, I know the second someone moves, that person's pulling their gun. So it really is a skill of pulling their gun. But
I think that's it. I think it's that the one, each person knows that the other person is going to react to their movement.
Yeah.
So they almost want to wait out the other. Like, if you are believing that you can draw quicker, if you see someone go for their gun, you want to shoot them before the draw comes. Hmm. But if they shoot you before, like if you're drawing and all of a sudden they get you first, I think that's what leads to the standoff. I don't know that it actually makes sense, because maybe you could try, but I think with the man with no name, if you went for your gun, you'd be dead. But you might be dead either way in that situation, because if you didn't go for your gun,
yeah, true,
you might still be dead. But I mean, you'd probably beat you either way.
Was this the beginning of standoffs?
I kind of doubt it. Okay. But maybe standoffs in this sense.
John Wayne had some before this.
Yeah, the 50s were big for Western movies.
Okay.
But I'm not all that familiar with the history of Western movies.
Okay. I'm just curious, because, I mean, I've never understood what the standoff was meant for. This makes more sense in the fact that they're just reacting like the game Ninja. But, yeah, I don't know. Either way, this is as to go back to your question at the beginning, you're talking about Leone, but he kind of started it in the Western films when he saw that the public eye wasn't viewing like these historical movie epics in a good light anymore. So he kind of just really just went with what the population was liking. So then he made this film, Fistful of Dollars. People loved it, so he made two more. That's really how it was.
Yeah.
So I think he was just following the public. I don't think he had any big story. That's at least what the internet says.
Yeah, and he had watched, at some point he had seen Yojimbo, and it makes sense. Like, I don't think you should discredit him, because essentially what they're doing is they're taking a genre piece to a different audience in a different country and a different culture that isn't accessible to everybody in the Western culture, because not everyone in the Western culture is going to go watch Japanese movies.
Yeah.
And then turning it into something that is accessible to the Western audience.
But you also have to understand, we reviewed Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
And like that was wildly popular over here.
True.
In the US. So it's like,
so samurai films were popular.
I'm just saying, like, that's not to discount your point, that's to go for your point, because it if you bring a different culture to another culture and make it look amazing, it's like it's a cool experience in a movie theater.
But then people love also ripping off Akira Kurosawa movies, because The Magnificent Seven was a ripoff of Seven Samurai.
People do that forever though.
Yeah.
And then The Hateful Eight.
But the Hateful Eight. I don't think you should. I think if I was a director, I would view it as a compliment. I wouldn't view it as like, oh, they're ripping off my piece of art. I mean, maybe in the future when I have a famous movie that everyone's ripping off, I'll be mad. But
everyone
typically that's what directors want. They want their mark to be made so that they can, like, you can see your movie in other movies.
Yeah.
But you also know that you took parts of other people's movies that you saw.
True.
And like this, all the way back to like the late 1800s when there was like 10-minute movies that had no sound.
Yeah.
And they were used as like magic shows. Like, oh, wow, we can watch videos on a screen.
A moving picture.
That's a moon. There's that one movie with the moon. It's like an hour and 2 minutes. What are they doing though? I need to watch that movie.
What are you
like
talking
1902.
About?
I feel like you'd recognize.
Oh, where the rocket's in the moon's eye?
Yeah.
Yeah, what is that? That's on my watch list. Wait, hold on. I have it right here. That's on my watch list for 2023.
Is it actually? A Trip to the Moon.
Yeah, that's on my watch list.
It's like an hour and 2 minutes.
It's George Mailis. Yeah, something, or Jorge Mailis. I don't know. But yeah, that's my number five.
All
that's
I know,
so funny.
I know of that movie a little bit because Martin Scorsese's movie Hugo references it a lot.
Hugo's made by Martin Scorsese. I never knew that.
You didn't know that?
I didn't like that movie.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not the best.
It's like a.
It's not a kids. Not a traditional Martin Scorsese
movie. It's like
movie.
For kids.
Yeah.
It's like weird. It's like Harry Potter.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit like that.
It was a little bit off-brand Martin Scorsese there. Sometimes he should stay on-brand.
He needed to keep his fortune a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this film influenced so many different things. I remember there was a scene in this that reminded me of a VeggieTales episode. That's how far this thing has gone. It's insane. And my grandfather, you know, everybody's grandfather knows about this film as well. They know Clint Eastwood is this public westerner film guy. But, you know, the most notable of the trilogy is obviously The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and obviously we'll talk about that in a few weeks, but this film kind of sets the stage for that, because I've seen parts of that film and it really is just this, just more intense, a little bit longer.
Really draw it out. Yeah, more Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
A little bit more plot.
There's less. It's less in one place. That's one thing I really liked about this movie, is that I like a good like self-contained movie that doesn't. It's not like spread out. It's like in kind of in one location, mm-hmm. which is just basically in one. I mean, they go to a couple places, but it's basically in the town. Which I think if you can make a good self-contained movie, that's a mark of you're a good director. Mm-hmm. You can keep it interesting within a certain space, basically.
Yeah. No, I mean that's very true. I think that worked well for this film. I think, I'm not sure, like, it's kind of hard to judge acting in these films. You know, how do you judge? Because none of them were good. You know, it's just fine. Clint Eastwood
was pretty good.
I mean, he improved over his career, but this is, you don't have to be deep.
I think the thing is there's, like, a certain appeal to, like, I don't know whether you'd call it campiness with these movies, but it's sort of something similar to campiness, if it's not just the word campiness. That's, like, it's, you know, it's not the best, but there's something kind of endearing about it at the same time. So, because none of these people other than Clint Eastwood really went on to be notable as far as I know. I mean, Joseph Egger was in like 76 movies, but most of them, I'm not sure I would have heard of many of them.
Yeah,
they were all within like 1935. For a few dollars more, which I guess his character, he's the old prophet, which he must foreshadow a few things in the movie. That's why they call him the old prophet. But it was actually his final film role of the 76 movies.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
No. For a few dollars more was his final. He's in for a few dollars more. Which that'll be interesting to see whether there's any continuity. Or it'd be kind of weird if he plays two different characters. Then we're like,
I mean, Sergio did not mean for these to be in tandem.
Yeah, because he just made this movie. I mean, this was the second movie he made.
But I'm saying he made all three of them to not be related to. This is stated.
Yeah.
He made all three to not be in tandem with each other. So I think people can theorize, and I think he left it open, you know, for stupid people.
Which
like
is smart,
to think about.
Because he's like, I don't want to close it off because this is something that people want it to be, obviously.
But I think he's just trying to copy what he did in each film, and hopefully he improved in each one. But the second, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the most famous one, right?
Yeah, so theoretically, by standards of how people like see the films, I think they usually consider The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly to be the best. Based on my peripheral knowledge of these movies, I think I would have thought overall people thought this, A Fistful of Dollars was his second best of the three. But I think a lot of people like stuff from the second trilogy he did, especially Once Upon a Time in the West, and maybe Once Upon a Time in America. I think Once Upon a Time in the West is usually one that people are like, they like a lot. Don't hear too much about Duck, You Sucker, but I also don't think you hear as much about For a Few Dollars More, but we'll see what it's like. That's the one that, yeah, I have no idea what For a Few Dollars More will have in store, but I'm excited. It makes me, like, it's a world I want to be in. That's what I like about it.
You would want to be.
I mean,
in that wretched
town. I don't want to actually be there. I want to be immersed in
invisible.
It. I want to be invisible, observing it.
Like a 3D movie, watching it all play out. That'd be fun. And like the bullets just go right through you. You're like, whoa.
I definitely would not want to be in that ruthless town where everyone gets murdered, because I wouldn't make it.
I wouldn't make it. Nobody would make it.
No, except for Clint
fictional
Eastwood.
Perfect characters.
Yeah. True.
But the VeggieTales was The Good, the Bad, and the Eggly. And then they also have The Good, the Bad, and the Silly. They did two spoofs of it.
Oh, that's the Cartoon Larry Boy. Mm-hmm. Cartoon Larry Boy is so good.
Yeah. Well, they also had a VeggieTales episode, The Good, the Bad, and the Silly. So that's different. That's not Larry
Boy. I'm not as familiar with that one.
Yeah, that one's newer. I think it's 2006, so pretty new. But, I mean, it's just wildly popular. And these are simple. Like, this is what I said this in my letterbox. Just, it's a simple plot, simple characters, some heroism, even though there's some anti-heroism. But it's simple. It's contained. It's literally just there. It's just a plot.
Yeah.
It's one thing, and it's great, and it's influenced so many other things. Why are we getting so in nitty gritty with these stupid movies? I don't.
Do you think it's because once you do it, you can't?
No, I don't think that.
No, because you could just remake this in a different context, right?
No, that's what Disney does. I'm saying we should take an easy story that's creative and new. There are an infinite number of stories to tell.
True.
That are creative and new. You know, if we can really get into it and think about it logically, there should be other original content that's good, but we're just not seeing that.
We
did not see that last year. Banshees of Inisherin was great. That's not what I'm talking about in this. That was simple, by the way. That was very simple.
Yeah.
People aren't friends anymore. You know, the Mario movie, it's great. The Top Gun, great. All of these box office hits because it's simple. We don't need like these new other movies that are just doing terrible, like, in the box office because nobody wants to go in for an overly complicated plot that's pushing a message on you that has terrible acting, terrible writing. The writers seem like they're on crack cocaine sometimes. Like some of these things are just...
They're shoehorning ideas.
I'm 21 years old and I can write better. Like, it's insane to me how much better I could write than some of these stupid writers. And this is simple. This was one idea some guy had sitting on the toilet and it worked out. Sergio did great and I'm just very impressed. So, you know, some of these garbage, are you looking up some of the
I'm
garbage?
Like,
Don't Look Up is a perfect example, okay?
Yeah.
Don't Look Up is overly complicated. It has all these guest stars and amazing things. It should be, like, theoretically amazing, right? It has a good Adam McKay directing it.
Yeah, good director. Good Leonardo DiCaprio's in it.
Yeah, good. Don't Look Up went down because it just pushes this thing, message on you. And
To be honest, I was very forgiving with a lot of my ratings of these movies. I mean, Triangle of Sadness is another good example.
Yeah,
that movie, just so...
I don't know. Yeah.
Pretentious, but it's also looking down on you.
Pretentious is a good word to use.
It's pretentious, but it's critiquing people who are pretentious and rich. But then you're like, but I feel like the person who made this is also pretentious and rich, so I don't want to listen to you.
More examples, Barbarian, Don't Worry, Darling.
Yep, those were
examples of
Glass Onion. I don't think. I think
what was the one with BJ Novak?
Vengeance. Yeah, same thing.
Just like they're trying to. I feel like people are trying too hard. Think of something original. Like Ben and I have a script. We can't prove it because we're not going to say anything. We have a good script with an original idea.
Original. Nobody's thought of it. I mean, a good example of a movie that has an original idea. I'm not sure whether I would. I mean, it may not really work, but is Crimes of the Future.
What is that about?
It's about people who want to have surgery and like perform surgery on each other in public. It's really weird.
Okay.
But it is an original idea. You got to give it credit for that.
Is it directed by
David Cronenberg?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Does it get weird?
It's really weird.
You watched it?
It's bizarre.
I need to watch that.
He starts at, like, they say stuff like surgery is the new sex and you have no idea what that means. Like, people want to, like, perform surgery on each other instead of having sex, I think is essentially the...
Okay.
And it's like...
Maybe I won't watch it.
It's really weird. But what I'm saying is that was an original idea.
Yeah. I mean, David is known, and, you know, obviously the Cronenberg...
It also got rated 3.3 on average and...
Out of 5.
Out of 5 on Letterboxd, which isn't great, but...
But yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, classic... Cowboy comes in. He's not even is he a cowboy or what is he? I mean, he's a cowboy.
He's
right?
a cowboy.
Yeah, he's a cowboy. He's comes in, shoots up a town, makes money off of these two groups, and it's very simple. In fact,
it's a little different, I think, than the traditional Western, though, because it's like the traditional Western, I feel like, is there's a cowboy. There's these people in danger. There's an oil baron. The cowboy's going to save the people.
That reminds me of Toy Story.
Yeah.
Where Woody saves them.
Whereas this is more like, this guy is, we don't really know who he is.
Yeah, this is like the postmodern interpretation of the Westerns. This is where it started.
Yeah, we don't know who this guy is. He doesn't seem to have too strong of morals, but then he gets like a soft spot, like to do something good.
He's redeemable.
But it's not because he's like that great. It's just because he probably had a crush on the girl, but he's also like a Sigma male, so he can't, he doesn't want to get with her. He
needs to be all alone.
It's like Drive. This movie is like Drive.
Kind of, yeah. He gets involved with the family, saves them.
It's
Drive except the husband doesn't die.
Yeah. Oh, right. And then he kisses the girl.
Yeah.
Drive maybe takes some pieces of this and then turns it into something else.
Yeah. Twists it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Makes him a little bit unfaithful.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it is. yeah, it's similar to a lot of things, just because the nature of the plot is so simple, you could apply it to many movies, to be honest. But like, yeah, it's just frustrating. Ben, we're gonna continue to watch movies in the past. I'm committed to that right now, at least for this season.
Yeah, like some of the movies that are on my list to watch include, well, of course, one of Zach's favorites, Vertigo.
Yeah,
like La Strada by Federico Fellini. A Man Escape by Robert Bresson, Persona.
Twin Peaks, you have to finish season 2.
Season 2, yeah. That's going to be probably one of the last ones because I got to finish season 2, and I think it's long. Yeah, and I got to finish Better Call Saul.
It's long.
So yeah. And then, of course, Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky.
And
Thin Red Line.
2001.
2001. I mean, 2001's, that's one of my biggest weaknesses of movies I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm. That is like a blind spot for you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and even Jaws is kind of a blind spot too.
But Jaws is less it's influential, definitely very influential.
It started, in some ways, you could blame Jaws for the movies we have today, though, because it started the summer blockbusters, what people say.
It did,
yeah. Which was good for a time, and now it's not that good because it's just superhero movies.
Yeah, I was wrong. I think Jaws, you do need to watch.
But yeah, and Zach also has a bunch of old movies, and this is why, because I think directors should have to watch a certain amount of old movies in order to direct, because I was thinking about this in the car. I was listening to The Doors, and I was thinking to myself, I was like, to me, listening to The Doors is just like I'm listening to a really good band. But I noticed somebody else listening to The Doors would be like, wow, this is really old, and I don't really like this because it's old, and I'd rather listen to something new. But I was just thinking, I exposed myself to enough art that now I can kind of view art as timeless. Like I can understand it was made in a period of time, but when I'm listening to it, I'm just like, this is good and I like it. I don't really care what time it was made in. And so I think that's kind of cool. And I think, and you can use time to your advantage, because we only have so much time to like consume things. And we really only should devote a certain amount of time to consuming stuff anyway. So we should kind of be a little bit cognizant of like, and I can't even say I'm always the best at this, as I watch Crimes of the Future, but but we should be a little bit cognizant of, like, in some aspects, if we watch things that aren't that good, we are wasting our time a little bit, other than we're maybe shoring up a little bit of our perspective on what's good and what's not. But I gotta tie this whole thought together.
That's all right. I think that makes sense.
But having an appreciation for the past, and you can use it to your advantage, because it's things have withstood the test of time. Like, everyone knows that The Doors' original album is really good, so you can just go into it knowing that you'll probably like it, and even if you don't like it, you'll be able to find something that you respect about it. Whereas if something new comes out, you don't really know whether you get that experience of being able to determine kind of completely by yourself whether you think it's good or bad, but you don't know whether it'll withstand the test of time the way that things in the past have. So I think that's extremely valuable, and knowing that like newer movies are, like, everything has to be built on the past. Like, nobody has a completely original concept, not even Death Grips, who say that they're in a completely original band that's not influenced by anything from Earth. But even they, there's no way that they're not. I mean, they had to have heard music at some point. It can't, unless they believe that they were
instruments?
Like, they were like, yeah, they use instruments. They have there a beat. There's a beat oxygen to their song. Maybe Merzbow isn't influenced by anything, but
I mean, I feel like you hear those sounds.
But then yeah, true. You hear he heard static on a TV at some point,
or in the womb of his mother.
Yeah,
it's just.
So that's my long rant about why you should try. And I still need to push myself to listen. I started watching Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr., which is from like the 1920s. And I paused it because I was like, I really need to give this time. And I was trying to like do something else while I was watching it. I was like, I should probably, like, it's a silent film, so you kind of have to like watch it. If you're not paying attention to the screen, you're not going to get anything. Like, the oldest movie I've ever watched is M, and it was 1931, which is old, but like, there's so many movies from the 1920s that are highly regarded that they don't have sound, but they're probably good, and I could probably learn a lot in terms of technique and see where that technique was applied later. So
no, I think you're right. I think your idea about it being timeless after getting exposure, we need to duct tape these directors to a wall and make them watch amazing movies so then they can learn what good writing looks like, right?
Yeah.
All right, I said director.
Writers. I mean, it's no it's no, like, it's obviously the story, you know, it's been immortalized, or that's maybe not even the right word, that like Quentin Tarantino like worked in a video shop, he watched all these movies, but like you have to like agree that a big reason why Quentin Tarantino is even close to being considered a good director is because he watched so many movies and he figured out how to take those movies maybe in more of a literal way than other people do and like apply them into his filmmaking. Like sometimes he was directly like kind of ripping stuff off, but he got away with it because he was ripping off stuff that nobody else had watched.
But don't you also think that some of these writers and directors don't seem like they love the source material? I just think of the new Velma series that everybody's raving about. I'm not going to go into this, but they didn't like the source material. You know, I think of Buzz Lightyear. I don't think that the writers and directors loved the source material like the fans did or like the original writers did.
Yeah.
So I think Quentin Tarantino is the perfect example of someone who loves what he actually writes. And he loves it to the point where he thinks he's a genius. And he is, really. But like, he knows he is. He's a self-aware genius. Many geniuses aren't self-aware.
Or they have this faux humility kind of thing.
Yeah. And he's not fake. He's like, yeah, I'm a genius, because he loves his what he makes so much. Some of these people just don't love what they make.
Anymore. Yeah.
And you can tell. But then the ones that stick out, you can tell the passion behind the writing. Every line counts. In this film, every line counted. Every line that the man with no name said, you can remember most of them.
Yeah. And listen to any Quentin Tarantino interview. He's one of the most annoying people. You probably would not want to be his friend. I'm sorry. Maybe you would be. But he's going to be one of those people who's always talking and you want him to shut up. But that's he's used that in order to be a genius. So even people's little quirks can be used to their advantage at some point.
Yeah, use the quirks. That's what we say.
Yeah, use the quirks. You got to use them. Like my quirk of, I don't actually know what quirk I have off the top of my head, but whatever quirk it is, I need to figure out what it is and how to use it to my advantage instead of it holding me back.
Yeah, whatever quirk I have, I don't know. Yeah. Probably a few in there. But yeah.
Like the quirk of scrolling through Letterboxd.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Fidgeting.
Yeah, fidgeting.
Use that to your advantage. I don't know how that would be helpful.
So we will see where we think this places in the pantheon of the trilogy. Yeah. But I
mean, maybe this is the best one.
It could be.
I don't know.
I need to rewatch Good, Bad, and the Ugly. I remember it being really good, but
I mean, we're gonna get
there. I feel like it might be one of those deals where I look at the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and I'm like, that's a better film. But I kind of like watching Fistful of Dollars better.
Sure.
And maybe it's just because it's an hour and 20 minutes shorter.
What did you give this on Letterboxd? 4 stars?
4 stars. I think I gave Good, Bad, and the Ugly 4.5 back in the day.
Okay. So maybe either Ben is different or it's a better movie.
Yeah.
Okay. I gave this 4 stars as well. Maybe 3.5.
Yeah. I think it's like, low 8, high 7. I think if I was getting technical, it'd be like 7.8, 7.9.
I did have one complaint. Just one. Like, because this movie's not trying to be... You know, it's not trying to be anything extra, so I'm not going to grade it for extra things, you know, like CGI. I'm not going to grade it for anything like that. That'll be dumb to apply to. The lighting, I didn't like sometimes. I feel like some of the scenes were very dark and I couldn't see what was going on. And then some of like the choreography, specifically in some of the scenes where a lot of stuff was going on, it was hard to tell who was who because a lot of times their faces weren't facing the camera.
Right. So, and maybe that's a little bit of the low budget
kind
of getting in the way. The lighting definitely seems like that would be have to do with budget. The choreography could just be directorial error.
And those aren't things that ruin the experience. It was, I think there were a few times, maybe it felt this too, where like I didn't really know who was who and what was going on. I had to kind of make when they had conversations after, I put two and two together.
Yeah. I think I do remember that happening.
Especially at the beginning. The beginning was a little confusing. So, but I like that it like stepped in a world where it immersed you into the conflict already.
Right.
That was nice. So.
Yeah.
It didn't have to do any mansplaining to me through a movie. No,
you don't have to do background explaining. You can do narration, but you have to do it right. And there's a way to do it right and a way to do it wrong. Mm-hmm. But it is, you can never underestimate. And this is why a lot of the new A24 like independent movies have been, people have liked them, because they stick to this model where it's like you got 5 characters and there's not a lot of talking and it's a lot of visual, because then you realize, oh, a lot of movies is the visual aspect of it. I mean, you could do dialogue on a radio show, play, anything, but you got to use the unique part of film, which is that you can use the camera. And that has to be like your guiding force. Some people can write dialogue really good. I know people love Aaron Sorkin, and people love even Tarantino could be a guy you could say is maybe even more liked for his dialogue. Yeah. But generally, the strength of movies come in the cinematography, and then everything else builds off of that. If you don't have good visuals, you're not going to draw people into your movie.
So. Yeah, I think you're right. I think because that seems like the one. Like, you can have a good movie with slightly bad dialogue, and you can have a good movie with slightly bad acting, but if the cinematography just sucks and the camera work is shaky and weird, then you can't have a good movie.
Yeah. I think that maybe this is just the way that I watch movies, but I think I tend to forgive movies with weaker plots that have a really good or interesting cinematography.
Sometimes. Because then we have movies like Don't Worry, Darling that I thought were pretty beautiful.
Yeah, but that's true. Then sometimes you can't forgive it.
Because I think cinematography is becoming very easier in the CGI age. So it's becoming, I think it's becoming very easy. And I think it's getting, like, you kind of have to filter out, like, this is cinematography without any substance. So I'm kind of getting sick of it a little bit. Like, I think of the Star Wars sequels.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Like, choreography, great. You know? Like, these images, CGI is amazing. Even Marvel these days.
Yeah.
Know?
Like some of the CGI is not that good.
I mean, they rush a lot. But, like, some of these scenes are, like, the CGI is awesome. And some of them, like, the cinematography is amazing. But the story's not there, forgettable.
Right.
So I think there has to be something there as well.
Yeah. And I think, like, the final, like, and, of course, the soundtrack to this movie is very famous. You kind of have to have this package of things. The more things that you remember about a film that stick to you. Sometimes it's like you watch a movie and then, couple weeks later you're like, man, that was a really cool movie. I kind of want to watch that again. That's when I kind of know I'm like, okay, I really did like that movie a lot, because it has sort of a subconscious hold on you where you're like, there was something that was distinctly memorable or cool about this movie. And a lot of times it's usual visuals or soundtrack, but it's really probably a combination of everything,
like
Donnie Darko
style. Yeah
like style or atmosphere, film atmosphere. Because film, I guess, in all art is kind of about evoking emotion. So anything that can evoke emotion tends to be. But you know, there's different styles of film. Some films are more straightforward, and they don't need like crazy, you know, experimental camera angles to get the story across, and they have a strong story. But that's the beauty of film.
I mean, that's what we were talking about in the very first podcast where we said, I didn't like how glitchy the camera looked.
Yeah. But I loved it.
Yeah. It just hurt my eyes, man.
Right. I could just take it, you know,
you're tougher than me.
Did you have any final
thoughts on, I mean, just because the nature of the story is pretty simple, I don't have anything else, but I think, overall, you know, we're thinking about cinematography. If the lighting was a little bit better, I think we would have some better shots. But there were some cool, like, horse riding scenes that I liked. They were pretty long. They spent, like, a lot of time showing these them riding horses. I said horses with a Z. I mean, that's really it. I think Clint Eastwood, this is a great start for your career. I'm glad you can make us enjoy a movie once again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we'll see if they improve. I think there could be improvements made. We'll see. Hopefully in a few dollars more. You know, it's a little bit more. It's what, 3 years later, 2 years later, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
So hopefully they took it and they paid Clint a little bit more. But let's not look that up yet. Let's find out.
We'll find out next episode. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, yeah, this is a great movie. What's that thing that we used to do in the very first movie vault? We had like three different things. Like, we would say, like, watch it, don't watch it, or...
Oh, but botch, Brian, watch, or top notch.
The botch, watch, or top notch. So this is firmly in the watch for me.
You don't think it's top notch?
It leans towards... This is why we probably stopped doing it, because it gets too black and white.
No, you can keep it fluid and say between.
I think it's between watch and top notch. Because I don't know what percentage of films I have to put in top notch. But it's very good. I think if you're a Western fan, it's top notch. That's what I would say. Okay. If you really like Westerns, you have to watch this movie.
Yeah.
It's a must. Yeah. Because it's the first in the Dollars Trilogy, and then you have to watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly because it's the last in the Dollars Trilogy. Maybe the one you don't have to watch is the next one, but maybe I'll like it a lot and I'll say something different. But
I agree. I think it's between watch and top notch as well. A little. I think it's a little bit above a watch. I think you should watch it.
Yeah, I definitely think you should watch it. If you like movies, you should watch it.
Yeah.
That. I mean, maybe I'll say that. Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll make your grandpa disappointed. You know.
Like, I think I would have given. I would have given National Treasure between a botch and a watch.
Me
like,
too.
Wait, I might have just given it a botch, but like I could see if you want to turn your brain off for an hour, two,
then listen
and a
half to
or
our
two
episode
hours.
On it.
Yeah, then listen to our episode on it. You can turn your brain off for that one. Yeah, I was trying to give an example of a botch that we did recently. We tend to not like try to review bad movies unless they're like really bad and they're fun to review.
Because we only have time
unless,
for so many movies.
Yeah, again, like it goes back to my time thing. You don't want to waste your time watching movies that you're not going to like. That's why I think you should try. You shouldn't try to do the thing on Letterboxd where you're perfect, like 50% is like a majority of your movies. Like, consider that the bottom 25% of movies are really bad and that you're probably generally watching in the 60 to 100% range and rate based on that. So 3.5 should be like your highest. That's my opinion. Unless you actually watch the other stuff.
Like this one guy on Letter, we won't.
But
say
there's
who.
Too many good movies that you should be doing that. I think, like, I don't think you got to be watching a lot of movies before you can truly have a 0 to 100 in the perfect like pyramid.
It's like
anyway,
the guy we follow on Letterboxd watching 5 movies a day.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Before I get too many tangents, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.
This has been the Movie Vault. It's time to close the vault.
Yeah. Ready. Doo doo doo. Bow, bow, bow.